Welcome to Ex Chateau.
Ex Chateau.
The podcast that navigates the business of wine with unique perspectives and insights. With your hosts, Robert Vernick and Peter Young.
Welcome to this episode of Ex Chateau. Today we're continuing our exploration of the wine importing market and seeing what it's like starting a new importer. So today our guest is Devin McGee, owner and founder of Offshore Wines. Devin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Peter. Very excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Could you give us just a brief overview of your background to start us off?
Sure. Yeah, my origin story is I got to study abroad when I was in college and ended up in Logroño, Spain, which is in the La Rioja wine region. I was 20 years old, had never really been a big wine drinker. And that kind of opened my eyes to the world of wine more in terms of people my age, you know, i.e. 20 years old, drinking and enjoying wine and having fun around wine and talking about wine. I'd always thought of it as kind of like an old person's drink or passion. And I finished college right after 9/11 and right when the economy definitely took a major dip. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And there were not jobs hanging off of trees for a recent college grad. So I ended up moving home to Seattle, which is where I'm from. And still kind of just remember the wine experience and was interested in doing a job maybe that was non-conventional. And so I inquired about working in wine, and I ended up applying at the biggest retailer back then. This is 20 years ago in Seattle in 2003, called Esquin Wine Merchants. And they asked me if I could carry 36-pound cases of wine. And that was one thing I definitely could do, even though I had, you know, next to zero wine knowledge. And I started there. And from there, it, as you know, Peter, working in the wine world is intoxicating, addicting, a lot of fun. It's a great community. And so I think once you dip your toe in, it kind of, it pulls you in all the best ways. So I worked there for a little while and moved up to being I was in charge of receiving the wine. So I checked in every wine that came in and kind of opened my eyes to just the amount of wine, the diversity of wine that was out there. But I noticed I knew Spanish. I spoke Spanish from my time studying abroad. And I realized that there was a lot more French wine coming in than Spanish wine. And I saw how excited people were about French wine. I got to taste French wine. And as I was checking the French wines in, I could not pronounce the labels for the life of me. And so I decided that if I wanted to continue my wine journey, I should learn French. And also at the same time, I realized that I had been working in a city in a wine store and had never really seen a vineyard or seen the inside of a wine cellar. And so I kind of made it a goal to learn French and to do a harvest in France. And fast forward, I got to, in 2006, I ended up being able to do harvest at Vieux Telegraph in Châteauneuf-du-Pape after spending about a year in France, kind of continuing to learn French. And that kind of opened my eyes to a lot. And from there, I've kind of worked in a lot of different parts of the wine industry. I've worked in production, doing other harvests. And I think that, and I worked in retail, which is kind of my origin. But all along when I started in retail, I was, back then, Kermit Lynch was kind of the enigmatic kind of artisan, especially up in Seattle, wine importer. And so I was really into the wines from the south of France that he was importing, really into the idea of it. I was really into writing. I wanted to be also a writer. And so I got to read Journeys on the Wine Route. And all of that kind of got me excited about importing.
That's his book?
Yeah, his book, or exactly. From
his newsletter? Okay.
His book, yeah. He published a book. I think it's from when he was first kind of discovering, quote unquote, a lot of his producers in the late 70s. It's a great book, and it talks about his discovery in time with producers that are, you know, like Marcel Lapierre, producers who are fairly well known in his book now, but, you know, decades ago. So it was really interesting to kind of see, and that always planted a seed in my mind of, ooh, you know, wine importing, I get to speak different languages and travel and write about wine. Yeah. And it was a long, long journey though. I basically got sidetracked by wine work. And in 2012, I got to go back to France to do a harvest. I was at a place where they used to say at least that all roads in the wine industry lead to Burgundy. And at that point, and especially now, at that point, it was really hard to, you know, to afford to drink Burgundy. So I wasn't really getting the exposure that I I would have liked to kind of continue my wine journey. And so I thought, you know, this is a great way to learn about a region is to go there and do harvest, and you get to drink the wines a lot more. The wine's a lot more accessible when you're actually there, and you kind of get your feet on the ground and get to learn a lot more. And so I ended up doing harvest at a producer called Chenon de Briey, which I'd done, I think that was like my fifth or sixth harvest maybe. And I had never had a super positive experience, I guess. I think a lot of it was because I'd worked at places that were slightly bigger, and that can quickly turn into just it's a lot of work working in, you know, in a cellar, and you can kind of lose
a lot of cleaning.
Yeah. A lot of water. And you lose sight of why you're there and what's actually happening. And this is the first time I was at a winery where it's felt more human sized, and they didn't overwork. This was, you know, I guess this is the beauty of France, but they, you know, we started early, you worked hard, but we had lunch and dinner together, and you still got to bed at a decent hour, but it was a lot of fun and I learned a lot, and it was just a really fun deep dive into Burgundy. And I got on really well with the whole family. And I mean the whole community at the winery. And it's kind of, I guess I would say for offshore wines, that's kind of my origin story in a way, because that was ground zero for a community that I've been lucky to be a part of in Burgundy. And it was just a really cool nexus. It was a moment of time that then has bloomed quite a bit since then. And in particular, I got to know the winemaker there, whose name is Christian Knott. And he was a younger than me, young winemaker. I right away saw that he was just, to me at least, next level, honestly, savant winemaker. He didn't take notes, but he knew everything. And he was my first introduction into making, you know, quote unquote, natural wines. And he was doing it with a lot of experience and scientific background, which I thought was really interesting. And he was just a nice guy. And in that harvest, we also became really good friends. And so I went back the following 2 years. So I went in 2012, 13, and 14. And then after that, we kept in touch. I'd go back once or twice a year just for fun. Was kind of at a point where I was like, I don't know if I want to go back and work harvest. It's a lot of work, but it is fun to go back and visit. And then in 2016, he and his partner at the time, Morgan Sayo, who's actually from the Haute Côte of Burgundy, from Burgundy, she kind of had the inside track and the desire to farm some parcels that she found in the Haute Côte, kind of above Pommard. And so she started making wine. She started farming, and he helped her to make the wine. It was her vision in the beginning, and they started a small domain called Domaine Dandelion. And after the 2016 harvest, Christian reached out to me and said, "Hey, why don't you import my wine to California, or our wine to California, excuse me." And that kind of got the ball rolling in my mind and kind of rekindled my original desire to import wine. And at the same time, I'd gotten to be good friends with Christian's friend, who he'd studied at winemaking school in Burgundy with, named Charles Dufour, who makes champagne. And he lives about just north of Beaune in the Aube, so the southern part of Champagne. And he would come down, he would always finish harvests earlier because it's Champagne, and he would come down and kind of help out and just hang out in Beaune. I think also because then, you know, he was a single young guy living in a pretty rural part of France, and Beaune was one of the closest places to go see friends and hang out. So I got to know him really well as well. I counted him as a good friend at the time as well. And so I texted with him and said, "Hey, I'm going to import some of Christian's wines, Domaine Dandelion. How'd you feel about working with your wines?" And the first shipment then was 2017, and it was literally 4 cases of Domaine Dandelion and I think 20 cases of Charles Dufour's champagne. And that's kind of, uh-huh, that was the start.
So you started in 2017. So give us just like, what's the scope of offshore wines? Like, what exactly do you do, and how big is it, or number of wineries and all that kind of good
stuff? Yeah, it's a definitely, you know, an ever evolving community. You know, I started with just 2 producers and slowly kind of added a few more. There's definitely a pause in terms of courting producers or being able to go back to France and visit people during COVID. And then since COVID, I'm kind of continued to stretch, expand a little bit, but meaning that I'm kind of in that like 15 to 20 producers range, I think, right now. And my goal always with offshore was that kind of started with the idea of, I really fell in love with Burgundy, as a lot of people do when they go there. There is something really really special about the region and almost spiritual in a Venice way, or any way, I guess, that you want to approach and get in touch with Burgundy. Something to do, you know, the monks have been making wine there for hundreds of years. It's also, I think, kind of it's ground zero for a lot of organic farming and food, including meat as well. And I know there's a lot of other corners of France that are the same way. I just happen to be in Burgundy. And I really felt that. And I think that throughout my wine path, I love drinking wine. I love being able to experience wine. I find it sometimes that when really kind of sought after collectible wines get to a point that they're so expensive that people like you and I get priced out of even experiencing them, I don't think it's fair to the wine passionate. And I think that those prices are not necessarily reflective of the producers themselves. And I think it's more people in the middle get involved and the prices speculate. And so my goal with starting in Burgundy was to find wines that were being made in a really artisan way. People with knowledge and experience were making great wines from maybe a lesser appellation, you know, in terms of Burgundy. It's not maybe Grand Cru fruit, but I think especially as times are evolving in terms of most of ripening of global warming, basically, but just that a lot of these regions are ripening, a lot of these sub-regions are ripening better, so to speak. I think that I just found that places like Domaine Dandelion were making, I think, high quality wines, and they were in a transparent way, in very small production, because it's really hands-on, and that the pricing was quote-unquote affordable. And so my goal was to find producers like that that exemplify the terroir of a region, and starting in Burgundy, in a region that's really well-known and has a lot of tradition and I guess like brand recognition, but also really expensive wines, but to show that, hey, this is an important wine region for a lot of reasons, and here are wines that you can actually afford to drink and taste, understand, and see why.
And so in your world, what is that affordability sort of price bracket in retail, what a consumer would pay?
Really good question. I think it's different for everybody. I guess that I would say in that under $100 range, and I'm not saying that these are everyday wines. I just like to think that most people, not most people, that, you know, I tend to look at things sometimes, you know, myopically through my own lens. But I think that for me speaking, like for a special occasion wine, a stretch, I can reach up to maybe $100 retail to buy a bottle and share it with having a special occasion. And so I think for me, these wines in the kind of like retail, like $30 to $100 range, you can find really, really special wines. I don't think that you necessarily need to pay more than that. And obviously it's different for everybody depending on their income, what they make and what they choose to spend money on. But I think that at some point the wine prices get to a point where you're losing a huge base of passionate people that want to drink your wine. And I think that's really unfortunate. And I think it's unfortunate for the producers in particular, because I think that those are the people that they want to be sharing their wines with. And I think that they do that at the, you know, at the cellar door maybe, but then sometimes by the time these wines get to California, for instance, they've just gone through so many different channels that the pricing is way out of skew. And so,
yeah, definitely. Especially for Burgundy.
Especially with Burgundy.
So tell us about, you know, what it was like to start up the import business. Did you have to do a ton of paperwork? Was it hard to get an import license, or was it super easy? How long did that take?
Yeah, it was definitely a Kafkian experience. It was back in, I think, the summer of 2017. And back then, the ABC had an office, or had all their offices, or a link or a center of offices in the Frankagawa Center downtown Oakland. And I was living in Oakland. And so in some ways, I was very lucky because I could just go there and start this process. I believe since COVID, they've moved the next closest office. Now it's Concord. So I didn't have to drive very far. But it was a very complicated experience because I did it on my own. I didn't have any help. I didn't hire anybody. And I just kind of started with step one and kept going until, you know, they told me I didn't need any more to file any more paperwork.
How many steps were there? Is it all like just paperwork or what?
Yeah, I feel like I blacked out during the thinking back on it. There were a lot of steps. It just kind of kept going. I will say that the ABC office, it was kind of, it just took a lot of patience and time in that you know, if I showed up at the office or called, if I got the right people to help, they were very helpful. And so they were very helpful in telling me what I needed and what I needed to do. So in the end, it was great. It just takes, you know, a level of patience to kind of have the time to wait for the person who can help and all of that. But it took, it took weeks, months to kind of get it all together. And I just kind of, yeah, I just kept going. But once it's together, it's, yeah, once you're in, you're in. So I'm lucky to have the necessary licenses now. And, you know, now I just renew them every year. So it's a straightforward process. I think one of the hardest things, honestly, I remember is I think I kind of thought that, oh, I'll just ship the wines to like my basement or something. And you need a licensed warehouse to receive the wines. And so that was kind of a difficult thing, was just to find, okay, how do I find that specifically licensed warehouse that can receive wines? And in the end, it all worked out. I found a great place that I use called California Wine Transport down in San Jose. So yeah, I think, you know, in the end, it just takes, you know, patience and organization. And
did it take like a lot of lawyers and legal fees and things like that?
I think that that's a route you can go. I honestly did not use lawyers. So I just paid the licensing fees. It's not cheap. I want to say that all in, it was, you know, between $1,000 and $2,000 maybe to get the licenses that I needed. I think that you could, if you have the financing, you could probably save some headaches, frustration, and time by using a lawyer. I think that's just someone who already knows the layout of how this all plays out. You know, that would have been helpful. You know, I really wish that I had someone that just had the game plan and could say, okay, here are the steps you do. And going in blind, it was definitely a challenge.
Right. And so is it very capital intensive to start a new importer? Obviously, you've paid to get your license, find a warehouse, bring in the first shipment of wine. Is that like, was that super expensive?
Yeah, I would say that the first shipment that I received, I self-financed, and it was not cheap, nor was it overly expensive. I mean, I'm not an independently wealthy person by any stretch of the imagination. So I used just a small amount of savings to finance to pay for basically the first shipment. It's definitely, you know, it is a small shipment, obviously. I would say that it can be for sure challenging. I think that a huge challenge for both producers and importers and is that the cash flow is, the timeline is very challenging in that producers ship their wines. In an ideal world, they would be paid right when they ship their wines. However, when they ship the wines, it takes typically between 2 and 3 months for them to land at the warehouse here in California. I'm speaking from France. I think fast, it's usually about 2 months. And this is in my experience. Maybe other importers have different experiences. And then to turn around and sell the wines, most restaurants and retailers have 30-day terms to then pay me or pay the importer. So, you know, even if you sold the wines the same day that they arrive, which is typically not the case, you're looking at a 90-day gap of, you know, the wine shipping and then the importer being paid. So I think that the big challenge is just how do you float that amount of time between wine shipping and then actually receiving money. And then in terms of,
because your terms with the wineries is you pay them right away when it ships?
It really differs depending on who you work with. I think that the industry standard in the best way, or sorry, not the best way, the best way for me that has become kind of industry standard-ish is 60-day terms. So I would pay the producer 60 days later. Typically, new producers will understandably want money when the wines ship, just as kind of a vote of confidence. I've worked with other producers that we work out like 50%, 50-50 terms. I want to make sure the producer is comfortable in everything. I think that's, to me, is kind of the most important part of all of this is representing the producer and making them, you know, making it as comfortable as possible for them. But, you know, I think that long term, yeah, typically it's 60-day terms to pay the producer after the wine ship. Yeah. And then 30-day terms on this side. So there's definitely a temporal gap between wine shipping. And so depending on how much wine you're importing, and my goal always was to start small, partially, you know, for financing reasons. Also, just because I like the idea of these, you know, these of small producers really, you know, making artisan wines, and that these wines will sell out, and that there is it highlights in my mind, hey, there's not a lot of this wine made because this is, you know, one person or a couple making the wine, versus in some ways, you know, the fake market where some wines that are extremely expensive, yet they're mass produced. So, but that idea for me also kind of helped that I'm not financing, you know, containers of wine to be shipped here. I'm typically getting one pallet or less than a pallet at the most, I think a couple of pallets, but they're small drops of wine.
Got it. Yeah. It sounds working capital intensive. Mm-hmm. To get it to sell. So the notion of being a wine importer, even for you loving wine and all that, seems like a dream, right? It seems like such a great gig where you travel the world, find new producers, bring them in, you know, like eat a lot of great food, drink a lot of great wine. How much of that is fiction versus the actual reality of doing it?
I would say that a lot is the reality of doing it. You know, this is definitely a passion project for me, and my favorite times are traveling and connecting with the producers and the places I get to go. And it just feels like I am living in kind of this, right, living in that narrative, in that seemingly fictional book. I love speaking French and Spanish, and so I really enjoy spending time in France and connecting with the language and the culture and the people. I find the winemakers in general, and in particular the ones I get to spend time with and work with, are unique. They're really unique human beings. They're extremely intelligent and passionate, and they're rural. So it's just an interesting mix of spending time in rural France, which is typically very beautiful and very verdant, and with people that know nature and vines and this really unique corner of the world extremely well, and they can express it in great stories. And so I love, and then, you know, obviously there's the other part of getting to eat the food and drink the wine. That's all, it's amazing. I would say that the fictional side of it all is that it is the double-edged sword, the silver spoon. It's a lot of fun. It's also, it is very exhausting, and I'm not going to complain about being exhausted getting to travel to France and eat great food and drink great wine. But I think in particular, as I get older, it definitely does take a toll in terms of just your health. I used to really enjoy going there for long periods of time. And I found that, you know, staying, honestly, you know, going for more than 10 days can just, you kind of start to feel the lack of sleep and the food and wine. So there is that side of it, that it does get a little exhausting. And then coming home, you know, it takes some time just to get readapt to life when you get back home. I think ideally France would be like a 2-hour drive up the road or something. but
I guess it is if you're in Spain or Germany.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But no, I mean, overall, it's why I do it. And I think that on the flip side, that's what keeps me going, is kind of sharing the wines and stories with people here in California. And I feel like it is like you're opening this pictorial experience book that you're, or, you know, bottle in this case, you're opening a bottle. And I hope that the experiences that I've gotten to see that are existing, you know, in a parallel world in France are kind of like shown in at the table or at the restaurant or retailer or with the people that we're talking about these wines and drinking them. So it is kind of this kind of sharing a slice of the world with people. And that's, I think that energy and those moments continue to shine over here. And that's definitely what gets me excited about all of this.
And so you bring in a lot of your friends' wines that you worked with in France. How do you think about which wineries to partner with?
So much of all of this is timing. And, you know, I both kind of, I wish I could go back in time and have started this, you know, 10 years earlier. But I think that I also just needed this trigger to start. And I think that for me, and I've noticed this with other importers, that a lot of importers' portfolios are really kind of around the timing that they began in a region and the generation of people that they are with. So I think starting to go to Burgundy in 2012, I got to know the community there that I feel really lucky to be a part of, and kind of watched everyone slowly grow. A lot of people at that time were working for other wineries, just like Christian for Dandelion. And since then they've kind of gone on to start their own thing. And so, you know, it took a lot of time to kind of, for all this to happen. And through them too, through that community, I got to meet other people. And it was kind of a really, you know, looking back, it was a long game. It's not really plug and play. And so I think that I've, to be honest, Peter, I've asked myself this question over the years, because Because I think that the wine world is just, it changes so much and it continues to evolve, I think, a lot faster than it did back in, you know, Kermit Lynch's time. And so, you know, I used to think also that, oh, you go to France and you taste wines at retail shops that you trust and wine bars and restaurants that you get to know and really look at their lists. And I still do that. But I think that, you know, I think a lot of people are doing that now. I think that the path to France, the path to Beaune is well known. And so a lot of Americans, a lot of Californians are going there frequently. And so it really just becomes, I think that the base for me has been really a relationship base. So it's just talking to people and getting to know people through people. And that's how I've been lucky to find a lot of the producers that I work with. I think there's also a certain vetting that happens. And I mean, a lot of this is relationship based in the sense, like, do you click with the people that you're working with? And so often, you know, friends of friends are friends. And so I think that, you know, it's that recommendation of, oh, well, so-and-so, I know so-and-so and you, I know you. And so I introduce you. And then it's kind of, it opens doors versus just reaching out to someone via like Instagram or something of like, hey, I had your wine. I think that producers are getting a lot of that. So I think it takes an extra in. So it has been just a lot of the relationships that have like slowly snowballed. I started to work with a producer in Australia and one in New Zealand, which goes back to an original relationship that started in Burgundy, you know, that goes back 10 plus years. So that's not necessarily me going to a salon and tasting, you know, hundreds of wines and saying, oh my goodness, that wine, that producer is above, you know, and beyond. It's just really kind of trusting people's recommendations and people's works. And then also that we click together. So it's kind of, yeah, it feels more like a community that grows than just finding like this one wine that, oh my goodness. I drink a ton of wine from other importers, and I'm not going to sit here and tell you that like the wines I import are better than anyone else's import portfolio. I think that the part of the fun of wine is just the diversity of producers and products. And one thing I love about California is the amount of wine that we have access to. So I'm happy to, you know, drink everyone's different wines. And I just, yeah, I think that so much is just based on getting to know people. And I think for me too, it's really getting to know the work that people do. I think that I've learned that to really trust in the, if I, you know, trust and respect the processes of what people do and how they talk about it, and if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously a lot of this sounds like is very relationship based. What makes them, after getting to know you, want to partner with you versus some other importer that caught them on Instagram or was introduced by someone else?
Hey, good question. And, you know, and sometimes it works out that they do go with somebody else. I think, again, a lot of it is timing and being at the right place at the right time. I like to think that, me personally, I love speaking French. I find that, you know, super helpful to be able to speak producers' native language with them. I think that I find it's helpful to, I've had experience, you know, in vineyards and in cellars. So I'm always kind of ever passionate and curious to hear about what they do in the vineyards and what they do in the cellars. So I think it is helpful to be able to connect on those levels. And I'd certainly hope that producers feel like that they're talking to someone who understands what they're saying and wants to hear more and respects their work. And then I think in the end, there's a certain level of you click with people, you know, I mean, it's a super, as you know, the wine industry is a super fun industry. So it's, these are people that I want to spend time with. And I, you know, sincerely hope the feeling's mutual. And I think that kind of helps, that like, we want to talk about wine over a glass of wine rather than, you know, 20-minute meeting and then move on. And so I think that a lot of it is we click. And I think that, you know, some producers click with other people, and that's also great. But that's a really, yeah, that's a big part for me is that we all click. I, you know, and now it's like I blink and I've worked with some of these people for a number of years now, and these relationships just, you know, continue to grow. And I, you know, you get to know their kids and so much about them and spend time with them. And they're really, you know, special experiences. And in rural France, you end up often like spending the night, you know, at their, you know, their extra bedroom or wherever. And it's just really intimate experiences that continues to build. And so I think that, yeah, you want to, in the end, a lot of it, it's like, you want to be with people that you enjoy spending time with.
And so are your relationships with the wineries exclusive, or do they sometimes have multiple importers into the US?
Yeah, I think nowadays a lot of, I mean, for me, they're exclusive in California because that's really the only market I work in. I'm working with a distributor, a small distributor in Colorado who represents a little bit of wine there. But for the most part, I always, again, wanted to start this as I wanted to focus on producers that I wouldn't need to then look to all 50 states. I wanted to just have really close ties with building on the community with the other side of things, which are the restaurants and retailers here in California. And that I would never have so much wine that I would need to, you know, distribute to all 50 states. I also think that I like the idea that it's, you know, it's me here in California. And so I, you know, I'm very present with the people here. And I think that I'm, you know, California is a big enough state that I'm able to represent the producers here in California. There's no way, for instance, that I could go represent these wines in like New York State or New York City, because that's just, you know, it's 3,000 miles away and I don't live there. I'm not plugged into the scene. It's an exhausting experience to try to do both markets, at least for me. And I think that there's probably, you know, there's better people in New York who know the market and they could do represent these producers if there's enough wine there. So I'm really happy just to stick to California.
So I think you said you have 10 or 15 producers you import, right? What do you think is the optimal size for offshore?
That's a great question, Peter. And I have no idea. You know, I think that it's not really, I guess the size is just the, you know, the optimal producers. And so I'm not necessarily looking to fill a size. It's more just filling the niche for if there's the right producer that in the right moment that wants to work together, then that's great. I don't, you know, I definitely obviously don't want to get to like 100 producers. I want to make sure that I have the bandwidth to respond to everyone I work with when they reach out to me and to be able to represent their wines. So I think part of the fun is, you know, there's kind of a pace setter in the sense of I can't just go out and tomorrow go get 10 new producers. You know, it's everyone I work with is, a lot of these producers have taken years to be able to import their wines. And I have a few other producers that are still taking years to finally ship their first shipment. And so it's such a long game and long process that in such a slow build that I'm psyched to be at the place I'm at right now. I'm really excited to have kind of 15 to 20 producers. I guess that was kind of always my goal, was to get in that realm. You know, I think a really fun number would be 25 producers, and I'm slowly approaching that. And so, but that's just, you know, that's honestly just based on my emotional and just kind of passionate. It's not crunchy numbers or anything like that. It's just kind of a gut feeling. And
But a gut feel of how much you'll have enough time to actually respond to all of them for.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And just kind of a fun, little portfolio. And I think that, you know, outward facing, I want people to know that each of these, and they are, that each of these producers, a small portfolio means that I'm tight with everyone in it. You know, it's not just like never met the person and signed him up, got a shipment, and now I'm slinging their wine. It's like, these are people that I'm close with and they mean a lot to me.
And so being focused on selling their wines in California, what have been the most successful ways that you've sold these wines?
Yeah, my end goal always is, you know, in the end, I'm just a, you know, like a spokesperson or an ambassador or a conduit for these producers, and they're doing all the work. They're making the wines that I love. And so first and foremost, my hope and desire and goal is always that the wines speak for themselves and they're kind of the best sales tool. And I get it. It can be complicated. You know, I go to tastings and taste a lot of wines, and for a single wine to stand out can be difficult. And so first and foremost, just want to get the wines out there in terms of people tasting them. And I wish I was a more of a social media person. It's just not in my DNA, unfortunately. So I'm not putting a lot of content out on Instagram. I wish I was doing more, but I find that when I'm with producers or with clients here, I'm much more comfortable being present with them, and I'm not efficient enough on my phone to do both at the same time. And so I don't use Instagram as much. And it's more, I really enjoy just kind of like the actual personal connections, the face-to-face and the text-to-text or phone calls or emails. And so I like to kind of basically market in person and spend time with the people that I care about, but that are also passionate about wines and open-minded. And so I like the idea of sharing these wines with people that then also continue to like spread the word about the wines. And, you know, some of the funnest experiences I've had full circle with that is meeting people who, whether that be consumers or sometimes winemakers, who tell me, oh, I had, you know, this producer that you bring in, and it's kind of like connects all these dots. I wasn't the one that presented them that wine. It was, you know, a friend of a friend of a friend or something. And I finally get to meet them, and it's full circle. And that's been, I think, a fun marketing tool, is just, you know, sharing the wines with people that are going to share them, basically. Another fun thing I like to do is just to kind of, you know, share other aspects of what people are doing. Like Christian from Domaine Dandelion went to Ethiopia for the coffee harvest with this really, really rad coffee roaster that he's really good friends with, and I've gotten to be good friends with in San Ramon. His name is Matt at San Ramon Coffee Roasters. And they went to Ethiopia to do basically carbonic ferments on coffee cherries. And long story, full circle, finally Matt got the green beans after the whole process and roasted them, and then sent me a bunch of beans. So it was fun to like share those bags with people that have been early supporters of Domaine Dandelion, and share just random swag too. Like I made a small run of hoodies and just, you know, sharing those with people just to kind of, I don't know, continue just that this is like an actual tangible community that we're in. And I'm excited by this Alsace producer, Hubert Aucher, or actually as it's pronounced, Hosher, is his daughter. He has three daughters, and the oldest one is an artist. She's rad artist, and she made these really cool hoodies with kind of a word game on the back. And so she sent me some of those with this latest shipment that just landed. So I'm excited to kind of like share those hoodies with some of the people that have been fans of the wines, supporters, because it's kind of, I find it to be an extension of just this whole community, like the wine, the art, the coffee. And those are just really, I think, old school marketing techniques, very on a small level.
Yeah. Well, it expands on the relationship business, right? Relationships on the winery side, relationships on the customer side. Yeah, I think that makes sense. And so are you the only salesperson? And if so, how do you compete with larger importers that have like teams of salespeople?
Yeah, I am the only salesperson, and it's hard to compete. And I think that ideally I would love to have, you know, one or two salespeople. It's, you know, it's a weird point because I think that I'm also just not as big of an importer as the people that have a team of importers. So it's hard to justify. I have salespeople. I also think that I believe in teams. So I would love to kind of continue to build a team, and that kind of, you know, continues in the idea of a community. So, and you know, and I can't be everywhere. I think that I can't be at every market at the same time. So ideally it would be fun to have other people kind of spreading the love, spreading the info. I think I've been really lucky to be honest, that I started this. I didn't come from just kind of the one sector of the wine industry I hadn't worked in. I didn't come from a distribution side. So I never really sold wines to restaurants and retailers. And more recently in particular, I've been really lucky that I think other salespeople out there, they've kind of befriended me, or kind of like opened the door or introduced me to their world a little bit. So I've had a lot of fun getting to know and then becoming good friends with other people in the industry. And so I think that's been just a fun way to further kind of share these wines, is, I don't know, they've just kind of helped to like share the stoke and the energy about these wines. And so again, that all just starts at a very like organic small level. But yeah, down the road, I think that to continue to slowly grow, I'll definitely want some sales help. And again, I don't know. I've kind of gotten past the point of looking at this as like as a competition. I think that there were times early on where I would get frustrated with the competition side of this. And that's not why I think any of us who occupy this more kind of artist and import space, we're not in it to compete. We're in it for our love and passion for these wines. And so I don't look at it that way. I don't look at it as a competition. It's more just kind of, you know, all rising tide lifts all boats. So it's just kind of being part of the conversation, really. And it will be helpful to have the right team members to do that, you know, people who know the wines and are into the wines.
And so as a smaller importer, how do you think about, with smaller brands, how do you think about building those brands, like, and, you know, establishing them in people's minds and actually building them up as brands for the market?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And honestly, I think that's something that in the wine industry, I think about a lot. And I think that I just on a bigger level, I'm always kind of perplexed and then ask a lot of questions about, well, why is this one wine brand so popular when I know how they're making the wine and I know what goes into it, and it does not warrant, I think, both pricing and placement and popularity, if that makes sense. And I think, you know, it goes back to timing, and it goes back to people building brands early on. I think some brands were built on a lot of great raw materials, and they've kind of, you know, they expanded and turned it into something different, but they maintain the same brand presence. And I think that one of the struggles with these small, I think we're in a place right now where there's so many amazing small producers in the market, which is great. And I think that it's also such a challenge to go up against these kind of more household brands that have been well established and people know them. People can pronounce their names. And I think that, you know, a huge struggle for the little sector I work in with France is, you know, a lot of these brands are just named after the people and they're French people's names. And so for consumers, it's just really hard. Even for me, to be honest, it's hard sometimes to remember this little producer, this name, and it's a wine you don't see very often. And so I, you know, my dream would be that people build up a database in their mind and they get to know these producers. And for me, it's been a fun journey to get to know all these small producers, and it continues to grow. And the optimistic side of all this is that I think that there's so much room for these small producers to continue to kind of occupy space and continue to occupy wine lists and shelf space where other wines have spent a lot of time that I don't think necessarily deserve to be there. And I'm talking about just the care and attention that a lot of these producers take, that I represent, a lot of these other small producers represent, you know, in the vineyard and in the cellar. And it's real work. It's organic farming. It's huge for the planet. And also it's good for our general health. Like, I think you feel a difference when you drink that wine versus other wines. And so I don't have the answer, to be honest. I think I'll just continue to do, you know, my work and continue to share the wines and continue to kind of like keep getting these names out there and stuff like that. And I just hope that it snowballs. But I also understand the challenge. I understand that consumers want to be able to shop for wines based on names they recognize. And I totally get that, because I think it's just human nature that I want to be able to be a part of the conversation and my reference points are things that I know. And so how do we continue to, I don't like to necessarily use this word, continue to educate, but just continue to get the word out there. And I don't necessarily have the big picture solution. I just hope that we can kind of continue to do it. I think, I think a lot of it is just finding ways to interact with people that they can kind of, for me, I've always used footholds to remember things. You know, for me, a lot of it is like geographic and climatic. So, you know, it's like Burgundy and Southern France, and it kind of puts me in a place. I guess that's the way I remember things. And then also just one tool I like to use too, is I remember things a lot better if I see the people behind them. So I think partly, you know, the producers I work with don't necessarily come to California very often, but it's kind of just getting them in front of people, whether that be just their stories or their pictures. And so that it becomes not just like a bottle, but also a story and personality and person behind it.
Are there some like critical baseline marketing elements you need to do for your brands? I could think of like maybe sending them out for critics to review or things like that.
It's a good question. I mean, I come from a background where, you know, retail wine for more kind of traditional wines uses the critical scores and stuff like that. And I think there's a big space out there for this kind of next wave of wine writing. And I think it is happening. I think, you know, Aaron Askoff, who writes Not Drinking Poison, he hit the wine trail in France and all over Europe extremely hard and worked really, really hard to kind of get a lot of these stories out there and continues to do so. And he just wrote a book that has a lot of people's stories in it, which has been hugely helpful, I think, to get the word out. There's also Alice Firing, who's written a lot about it. And then I think we're seeing more dovetails. You know, Ray Isle just published a wine book that has a lot of smaller artists and producers in there. I think there's just a lot of room for more of these people to be represented. I don't really agree with the kind of the myopic, like scoring the wines and writing tasting notes for every single wine. I think that the wine world is evolving so quickly, and these small producers are making different cuvées every year because every vintage is so different, and it's based on just, and also with climate change, there's so many extreme weather events every year that they're forced to make decisions and then make often one-off cuvées. So it's hard to keep up with all that, but I think that just getting the word out there about what people are doing is hugely helpful. And I think it is starting to happen, and it's hugely helpful both for my work, but also just in the end for producers. So
you mentioned you do or like to do a lot of writing in the past. Do you do that? I've heard Kermit Lynch's like newsletters were hugely popular and influential. I was just curious if you use that to help promote the brands as well.
Yeah, I do send out, you know, I do communicate a lot via email, and I use that format to kind of write a little bit more info about the producers. And I like to keep their bios on the website, which I'm constantly updating and does need some updates right now. But my goal is to kind of have some writing that, you know, that I'm writing about the producers on there. I dream of kind of doing, you know, longer format kind of writing about these producers. I understand how our you know, in general people's patience when reading is changing and evolving. And so I find that writing an email, a really long-winded email, doesn't always, you know, people just don't have the time or bandwidth or attention span necessarily to read it. I'm not blaming anybody. I'm frankly the same way at times. So I want to keep that like as short and sweet as possible, but also get the, you know, the story and critical information out. But for sure, that's my, I love to put information out that way and via email and eventually via newsletter as well. And yeah, and I would, you know, I dream of writing some kind of a wine book. I find that, yeah, I'm very curious to see how wine writing will continue to evolve, because I came up in the wine world when it was a pretty, like, there was not a lot of wine writing out there, and it was pretty kind of specific how you go about it. And I think that it is, you know, it's really evolved and bloomed since then. And so I think there's a lot more out there. Like there's a big future out there of where I think it can, where it can go. And so it's exciting to think about how we are going to continue to write about wine.
The returns to writers has gone down significantly, though.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the other thing is, right, yeah. The amount of time
the economics have also changed a lot with wine writing.
Exactly. So then the time you put in and what comes back. But, you know, I don't know. I'm still excited to see what happens.
But there's synergies for someone like you where the writing is also like a marketing tool and can help sell the wines and things like that.
So. Totally. And I don't want to, you know, and obviously I have writing about producers I work with is definitely, I'm not like a unbiased journalist. These are, you know, these would be stories about people that I care about that are also helping promote their wines. But yeah, I would love to, my goal is to continue to write and continue to write more. It's always just, you know, finding the time.
Totally. So what advice would you give others interested in starting their own wine importing company?
That's a really good question and a complicated question. I think that the advice and the same thing that can get you in trouble, in a sense, like the advice given to me was always like, don't go to a wine producing, to a foreign, you know, whether that be Argentina or France or whatever. Everyone's had the experience of like sitting in an outdoor patio and drinking a bottle and thinking, damn, this is delicious. I need to import it. And that can both be, that's both amazing and can be the challenge. And so I would say, like, definitely, it starts with having an experience that you think that you want to share in your market where you live. And so, I mean, you know, I think that's a real easy advice to give, which is just, if you've had that experience and you think that you want to share it here, then that's your start. I think beyond that, it has to be, really has to just be a labor of love and a passion. And I think that honestly, the challenge will always be, where is selling the wine once it's here, and where does that wine, like, quote unquote, placing the wine. And so I think that the market side of the not as passionate side, maybe, is like the market side is like, it's really helpful to know, at least have, you know, a place where a friend that will carry that wine and that will help you represent that wine. So just kind of completing the full trajectory of, here's the wine I love, I want to share it. Oh, and here's someone that I've shared the wine with already and said, or who is passionate about this wine, who said, hey, like, this would be a great wine to serve by the glass or like in my wine club or on my retail shelf. Just to know that there's like a runway for at least one of your wines is really helpful.
Yeah, very, very similar to the advice most people give who want to start a winery, right? Like, as long as you can sell it.
right, exactly.
That's okay, right? Yeah.
I think it's really important to, if you love the wine, like to to hit it off with the producer, make sure you know who's doing the work, make sure that you peek behind the curtains, you know, to see everything. And I think that it's part of the, it's kind of like, don't get blinded by the pinstripes too, you know, in the case of what they say about the Yankees, like, you know, make sure that you're actually looking at what's going on to make sure that you fully understand what's actually behind the wine. It's just, in the end, it's your own vision and energy and passion. And so I think that, you know, people respond to people's passions. So if people trust you and trust your passion and you're relaying that message, then that's great. I think that it's a fun project.
And so we always like to wrap on a personal note. What is the most coveted wine in your cellar and when do you plan on drinking it?
Good question, Peter. I would say that the most coveted wine is a bottle, and I only have one bottle, and you did, just to be totally honest, you prepped me for this question. And so I've had a moment to think about it, and I both got excited and then really sad because I realized, yes, this is it's a true question. I have one bottle of this wine. To answer your last question first, I have no idea when I'll drink it because I unfortunately have one bottle. But the first harvest I did in Burgundy at Chenon de Briaye in 2012, they have a small parcel of Pinot Blanc. There just wasn't a lot of it. And this is where I feel like I got to see the winery's transition happening in real time. And then also Christian, the winemaker, who now is Domaine Dandelion, kind of flexing or flexing his kind of just mental creativity and experience and kind of all this happened in real time where we had the small parcel of Pinot Blanc, and it wasn't really enough to, you know, so much of winemaking is Tetris, and it wasn't really enough to put into the concrete tanks they had at the time, which were for bigger parcels. And so he had the idea of, he basically, and this is what I also love about him and just about France, is he had these, you know, these old winemaking tools and their old barrel tools. I'd never seen anyone do this. So he took a barrel, put it vertical, and very, you know, casually and coolly knocked off the metal rings around the barrel, which apparently you can do, took off the top, so kind of the head of the barrel, put the rings back on, and then if I remember correctly, we whole cluster fermented the Pinot Blancs. We did like a macerated Pinot Blanc in the barrel with it vertical. And then fast forward, basically just made one barrel of this macerated Pinot Blanc. It was the first time that the winery ever did, you know, this singular whole cluster Pinot Blanc. They made one barrel of the barrel aged in their cellar, and you go down their cellar. And at one point, I think it was the other intern, Chloe, who is from New Zealand, who did this chalk art on the barrel head. So it had the name of the wine on there forever. And it was called La Vie est Belle, like life is beautiful. And they bottled it. And I have one bottle in my cellar. And it's no sulfur, completely natural skin macerated Pinot Blanc. And I had a bottle, a friend of a friend was visiting, and I had a bottle a number of years ago that was awesome. And I have no idea when I'll open this one.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how long that'll age.
That is down there. Oh, I think I'm someone. I think as long as there's obviously the percentage chance that, you know, something goes awry with the closure, but otherwise, and I know that they used really, really great corks. Otherwise, I'm a big believer on wines will age for a long time. So I'm not as worried about it like getting too old as just finding the right time to open it.
Well, Devin, thanks for sharing your story and experiences with us.
Right on, Peter. Thanks for having me. And can't wait to listen to the other importer podcast. And thanks for doing this. Thanks for highlighting all of us.
Thanks for joining us. If you loved this episode of Ex Chateau, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Until next time, cheers.